This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The 2024 presidential campaign is on track to be the most expensive election cycle in U.S. history, thanks in large part to the influence of political action committees, or PACs, independent groups that raise and spend money to elect and defeat candidates. PACs tend to represent specific interests or ideologies, and their finances come mainly from the wealthy, various corporations, or labor unions. And in Delaware, an increasing number of PACs are both taking part in and significantly impacting the state's political landscape. This week, Delaware Public Media's Comican spoke with Samuel Hoff, professor of history and political science at Delaware State University, about the growing influence of PACs and out-of-state money in Delaware politics.
Why are we seeing this rise in PACs in Delaware's, you know, politics, and how long has it been going on?
PACs have been around since the 70s legally, and in the last 18 months at the federal level, the number is more than 8,500 political action committees. Here in Delaware, there are at least 141 registered, according to the latest numbers. The reasons are multifaceted. One is that the federal law and the Supreme Court decision that augmented that back in 2010, along with state rules, are pretty beneficial to political action committees. For instance, there is no limit on the amount that political action committees within Delaware can contribute as long as they adhere to some other rules. So that's a beneficial setup for a lot of the political action committees. Then we have to look at the expense of campaigns. You know, the TV markets, particularly Philadelphia, very expensive, and other methods of campaigning that, you know, were traditional are being replaced by digital and others. And you always have campaign consultants. So you add that. It takes a lot of funding to really fund a campaign. And it's hard for individuals often to do that on their own. They're trying to get funding from political parties, from individuals, and as I say, since the 70s, legally from political action committees. In Delaware, I think the number of political action committees has spiked because the number of candidates in particular within this particular election season, particularly our gubernatorial, where we had three on both sides of the nomination process, a Democrat and Republican. Seeing political action committees established as a essentially some link to a candidate, whether for personal or professional reasons. We've also seen some political action committees support candidates because of their positions on policy. And that seems to be one of the things that we've, patterns that we've uncovered. And finally, I think that the rise of these political action committees is concurrent with single issue campaigns across the United States. And when we talk about that, we're talking about very controversial issues such as abortion or gun rights, obviously immigration at this time, and crime prevention are the topics that are often supported by political action committees in a singular issue type campaign.
For Delaware specifically then, Sam, as opposed to maybe other states or regions of the country, why is the increase in PACs uniquely or significantly problematic here? Is there something about Delaware and this rise in the influence of PACs that affects the state in any unique way or its landscape?
Well, that's a very good question. And I believe that we have to think in broad terms today. We used to look at Wilmington as a sort of broad part of a metropolitan Philadelphia area, but we blocked the other two counties. Now we have to think about the entire state as part of that metropolitan area. And as I say, that specifically on issues of spending, where you got to get those funds in to reach folks in the out-of-state market, political action committees have filled the void that other folks would not be able to do in terms of that type of funding. So I really think that that's unique, and I don't think that it would be wise for political consultants or candidates to think any more in pure border terms, to stop, you know, trying to campaign and do so with the idea that there's going to be influence on the other side of the border, because there is, and we've seen it, and that influence is more and more. And it's concurrent with increase in population and changing demographic patterns that are important as we move on and look at Delaware's political opponent.
Maybe if you're able to just speak to this even anecdotally, what are you seeing in terms of PAC involvement this election season here in Delaware? Are we even able to assess that?
Well, yeah, we've seen the political action committees. As I said, there was one particular for Bethany Hall Long that supported her in her gubernatorial bid within the Democratic Party. And it was actually related to a position, national position she had for the Lieutenant Governors Association. And that's just one example of how an affiliation with a group can turn around to assist you in a campaign legally, in the sense that political action committee obviously formed and then contributed. So in that sense, I found it interesting because it's not a single issue and it's not a policy issue, what I call it. It's more of a personal affiliation for the reason that that political action committee contributed. You know, that brings up what PACs want to do in campaigns, and that is influence the direction in their way. And when we look at the federal PACs, we can see that, as I mentioned, over 8,500, they took in $7 billion and spent $6 billion over the last 18 months. Again, I say billion. That's PACs at the federal level dealing with the president, the House, and the Senate. So that gives you an idea of what their level they're at and what an influence they can have. Does money buy votes? I'll leave that for your listeners.
Well, how you touched on this, but how is all this in terms of who regulates PACs and campaign finances in our politics that's essentially non-existent? Can you walk us through that?
No, within the state, there are certain rules for the PACs cannot contribute to parties, and there are other basic ideas for regulating, but the amount, as long as they're properly registered, is the big allowance in the state at this particular point. As I said, the last look, there were about over 140. But one of the specific rules is that you can't specifically say we're supporting a candidate. And in that sense, you have to make your commercials creative. And you can tell them to support legislation. You can thank them for supporting legislation, thank them for their constituent service. And obviously, those are types of positive oriented commercials. But that's an important way to think about political action committees.
Yeah. And when we say, for those that don't know, when we say, you hear that term super PAC a lot, especially these days in recent years, what does that mean exactly? Is it just PACs on steroids, essentially, when it comes to finances and involvement? What does that mean?
PACs can be created in several types of organizations, labor, trade organizations. The largest type of PAC today is one that is called non-connected. So when you get a series of PACs, usually in the same broad area, grouping together, we call that a super PAC. Now, the federal government has scrutinized that, in the sense that they have previously ruled against what is called bundling, but that's loosened up since the 2010 Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court. And so you have those types of organizations getting together in the same context, in the same campaign.
Speaking in broad strokes here, I've read about concerns that democracy is going to lose its legitimacy if we don't do something about, you know, campaign finance reform and perhaps deregulate it in some fashion and somehow maybe put a cap on campaign contributions. I think that kind of plays a little bit hand in hand here with our discussion over PACs. But what do you make around that concept of campaign finance reform and potential deregulation in the context of political action committee involvement?
I think I comment on your broader question, which is, you know, what PACs might be doing to the political system, in the sense of the person with the most money might win. And that certainly isn't always the case. I did a study of presidential primary PACs back in the 70s and 80s, and found the person with the most efficient spending won. And that was not always the person who got the most PAC money. And so that's a big difference. But what I worry about, sir, is the diminution of trust in the political system for that, or a growing cynicism for that very reason. And how can we diminish that? Well, you had a point, I think, in referring to campaign finance to try to even things out, or you can find other ways. But what is kind of disappointing is to see some candidates who do a great job at being able to get small donations from contributors and supporters. And that does speak to representative democracy. But, you know, it's when we come in with these single large type contributions that things can go significantly off balance. So I think there are other ways to deal with it, both radical and subtle, but we need to keep an eye on that.
I want to finish with the role of the voter here, though, Sam. How much responsibility do we put on the voter here to do their research so they have the ability to sort through all of this and essentially repel the influence of PACs and their skewed messaging? Or obviously it's favorable in that sense, but you know, how much responsibility do we put on the voter here?
Our listeners as voters are going to express themselves through either supporting a candidate or opposing one, and we let them make that choice, you know, in their heart in terms of doing it. PACs in that sense are a legitimate part of the American political system, but ultimately we have to always think of the individual as doing that. And so, I mean, it's pretty easy to go on the Federal Election Commission website, and even easier to go on a Delaware election office site to be able to garner some of the statistics that I refer to here.
Thanks to Samuel Hoff, professor of history and political science at Delaware State University, and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us this week on The Green. And stay with us. The Green continues with Arts Playlist, where we learn about the new Delaware Art Museum exhibition focused on the Jazz Age. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media.